She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Hello and welcome to The Persistence. This is She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. My name is Beatrice, and I'm here with
Elizabeth. And today we have a special guest co-host, Amy Dreyer.
Hi.
Amy Dreyer is a friend of mine. From college. She's an activist, author, and amazing feminist. She's written for The Huffington Post, Medium, and is currently working on a novel or maybe two.
Yes.
Yes.
She was a women's studies major at Scripps and has worked on progressive political campaigns and issues throughout her career. During the 2016 election, she was a state delegate for Colorado to the Democratic National Convention, which she attended, for which I'm totally jealous.
Yes. Hi, that's right.
And she was a member of the Electoral College and got to vote for Hillary in the Electoral College.
I got to vote for Hillary like three times completely legally.
That is so amazing. Today, we are going to talk about women's rights in the US. So last time we talked about Austria, and today we're going to talk about the US. So I am not an American.
What?
I'm sorry. There are people as well that are not American. Can you believe it?
Lucky them.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, not always. At the moment, probably.
Yeah.
So one thing that really confuses me about American legislation as a non-American is that there are many differences in regulations depending on the state. So that's basically a question that I have to both of you. So could you maybe talk about what types of legislation are applicable to all of the US and which ones happen like on a state level?
I'll start, and maybe Amy, if you have stuff to add, you can add stuff in. So it's a good question, and the answer is basically, it depends. We have a really strong history, long history of states' rights, and in German, it's the equivalent of the system of Föderalismus. Basically, the individual states have...
It's the same in Austria, yeah.
Yeah, the individual states have the ability to pass laws that govern them, but if these laws are deemed to be, like, unconstitutional or in conflict with federal laws, then things are usually brought before the Supreme Court. And then once the Supreme Court rules on something, then it doesn't matter what the laws of the states are. It's now the law of the land and whatever. So one example would be Roe v. Wade. Every state has individual laws about abortion. But once Roe v. Wade was happened in the Supreme Court, it meant that abortion was legal nationwide. And if Roe versus Wade is ever overturned, then the states will revert back to what their laws were before. Unless they take action to change them. So this means that approximately 20 states that currently have laws on the books that could be used to restrict the legal access of abortion would be in place there. And it would be legal in about 30 states, give or take. And that's what happened with equal marriage protection as well in the United States.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, basically, states pass laws. I mean, I think another example of this in the United States is... that's not related to women's rights per se, but is marijuana being legalized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's illegal on the federal level, but it's legal in certain states. And so it hasn't yet been brought before the Supreme Court. I don't know if there are plans to do that. But I mean, Amy could probably speak more to that.
Yeah, it's marijuana is a great example, as is like marriage rights and it goes really deep into our history. The whole like states' rights is very important, and it held up a lot of, you know, what formed the United States. It's really comparable to the EU in some ways, right? But the fact was, like, the states weren't yet giant industrialized nations, right, with their own currencies. They really kind of, like, the timing was really right. The founding fathers got it right in terms of, like, getting in when people were just sort of coalescing into these identities. But still, they had very strong individual cultural identities within the states, and particularly, you know, the storied part of that is the North and the South and the different economies of the North and the South and the struggles of bringing those together. So that just has really endured. And, you know, 200 years seems like a long time to the US. It doesn't seem like such a long time to the rest of the world, right? But for us, those things are still really strong. And government is local. And you really, kind of can't export a solution that works for a state like Vermont to a state like California.
Yeah.
So it really, that's kind of where it comes up out of is, you know, you can't legislate one law of the land for such a huge, you know, geography and cultural differences among, you know, all of these peoples in all of these regions. So that's where you see, right, these different laws for different states. But yeah, cannabis is, it's interesting because for something like Roe v. Wade, it flows pretty directly out of enumerated constitutional parameters, right? Like you can find some pretty basic things in the constitutions that talk about or previous interpretations of right to bodily integrity, right to determination, self-determination. I guess even marriage equality, right? It's pretty straightforward. Cannabis is interesting. I do work in cannabis, and there really is no clear constitutional regulation around cannabis. I mean, I think that you could go to like interstate commerce clause is probably what I would see, where I would see people going to pursue a constitutional solution, like federal solution.
Not pursuit of happiness?
you know, so they, like, I'm sure that there is some like weirdo activist in Humboldt County who is making that case, right?
But in terms of like, for us, there's this, we have this big debate, and we'll get into this a little later, about healthcare and whether it's better regulated with the federal government or in the state governments. And in some ways, if the federal government could just give them money to run their state like healthcare stuff, like the argument is they're better equipped to do that because they're local and they understand the health issues of the people that are in those states. But that could lead to issues if they have laws on the books that prohibit certain things from happening in you know, medicine, like abortion, et cetera. So,
yeah, it really grows out of the American rugged individualism. It's really that's one of the cultural issues that really stops us from having common sense solutions like single payer health care system, or even like, even if it's not single payer, a national health care system, right? And it's a great intersection because a lot of mostly men, but a lot of the conservative activists who really push local rule and this, you know, sort of rugged individualism and self-determination are also some of the people who are most vocal in the anti-choice movement and who are most vocal in taking individual liberties away from women. I mean, obviously there are a lot of contradictions to explore, I feel, in some of the like anti-feminist cultures in the United States.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say to that topic, Elizabeth? Did you want to add something?
No, I mean, I think that that's all correct.
Yeah.
I think that, and we'll get into this as we talk about specific issues. I think that the Republican Party and conservatives in the United States have changed a lot, and they are very divided, but they pretend to be very unified. And I think that there are a lot of people who are kind of on the more libertarian end of the spectrum who are like, let people do what the hell they want to do. And they've got their own set of issues as well. But this desire to have this kind of paternalistic control over women and women's bodies is it's so old fashioned. It's not even early 20th century old fashioned. It's like 18th and 19th century old fashioned. And I mean, we've moved on.
Yeah. Last time we talked about the history of the women's rights movement in Austria. And we also talked about how women in Austria got the right to vote. So in Austria, that happened in 1919. Liz, can you maybe talk a bit about when that happened in America?
Sure. It happened in 1919 in the United States too, though it didn't actually become a full ratified constitutional amendment until 1920. But it's the 19th Amendment, which is convenient because it was passed in 1919. And it guarantees all women, American women, the right to vote. It was a difficult struggle. It took a lot of agitation and protest beginning in the mid-19th century, just like in Austria, and several generations of women suffrage supporters lectured, wrote, marched, lobbied, practiced civil disobedience, and it was a pretty radical change to the Constitution. There's a movie about the struggle of women suffrage movement in the United States called Iron-Jawed Angels.
Okay, never heard about that.
It's got Hilary Duff. It's really great. It's kind of the American version of the more recent film about British suffrage, which I don't remember the name of.
I think it's called Suffragette.
Yes. Yeah, Suffragette.
Yeah. Suffragette. Yeah. It came out earlier, but it kind of deals with some of the internal struggles that went on in the women's movement. There were two competing organizations that were formed by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth. Is it Cady Stanton? Cady Stanton?
I hear Katie all the time.
Okay. So Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and then the other was with Lucy Stone. And then they were like, mm-hmm. there were like a lot of rivalries. They merged in 1890 as the National American Women's Suffrage Association, with Susan B. Anthony kind of leading the way. And part of it is also a states' rights thing. The Constitution didn't give women the right to vote, but these new states and territories that were being formed in the western part of the United States were allowing women suffrage. And a lot of existing states were trying to change their state constitutions. So it was leading to a constitutional battle in the Supreme Court anyway, I think, even though the Supreme Court had kind of like not allowed arguments based on the 15th Amendment, which allows individual suffrage regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude, which is what allowed Black men the right to vote, even though they were also denied their right to vote through other means.
Mm-hmm.
So 1920 is basically when U.S. women got the right to vote. Throughout Europe, throughout the United, North America, mm-hmm. we see kind of this time period as the time period of women gaining suffrage.
Yeah, so that was the first wave of like feminism, or what's usually thought of as the first wave.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't, we'll talk a little more about like intersectional feminism. It was not, perfect. There were debates within the suffrage movements about excluding African-American women, but women generally got the right to vote, and that was the goal.
Yeah. So, and then there was a second wave. Yes. Surprisingly.
Second wave feminism is pretty awesome. Amy?
Yeah, it gets a really bad rap nowadays. It's almost second wave feminism is, I think, the only reason the suffragists are critiqued. The second wave feminism, I think there's this, I think in any struggle of an oppressed group toward freedom, there is always a drive to kind of eat your own, right? And particularly there's a lot of scholarship around in the women's movement, how that's that drive to critique what came before is really merged with this drive to reject your mother, right? Like there's all sorts of like very scholarly Freudian style things about like what it means to reject your mother and how ingrained that is in the women's movement as we move forward. And I'm not as familiar with second wave critiques around suffrage. I think women were just kind of starting to feel their oats at that time, right? And they were just really excited to have the vote. And at the same time, there was such a self-examination going on around consciousness raising, around the problem that had no name, women really understanding that suffrage wasn't the end, that the right to vote was just a beginning point, right? And so the second wave was really focused on, hold on a second, what are all of the other ways that we can actually be fully realized, self-actualized, independent beings that aren't property? Being property that votes isn't good enough. And so the second wave of feminism, they get a bad rap, but they did a lot. They did a lot of amazing things. And there was a lot of amazing scholarship as we're kind of approaching this intersectional feminism. I've heard, as we're in this giant wave of change with Me Too and the post Women's March era, I've seen in places people are already starting to look for some of that scholarship that was foundational in the second wave.
Yeah.
And, obviously the feminine mystique and outrageous acts and everyday rebellions. Even some of the stuff coming out over in Europe, right? And what the writings of Simone de Beauvoir, there was sort of this canon of scholarly thought and theory that was moving things forward. And there were these sort of great moments. And I think actually, I know we're going to talk a little bit later on about like, where are we now? But I do think that the Women's March will be that moment. Back during the suffrage movement, there was Seneca Falls. There was the gathering at Seneca Falls. And then in the second wave, there was now started having national meetings and chapter meetings. And there was the Condahee Women's Collective for the Black feminist movement. And there were these spark moments. And I think that the Women's March is going to be that spark kind of pivot point moment. And then we'll see some things starting to coalesce. I mean, you can already say, like, I think what I'm most familiar with is like Roxane Gay, right? Like, she is already starting to put down what I think are going to be those tomes.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about second wave feminism is there were things that were not necessarily part of law, but they were social norms of, like, women not having access to money and having their own bank accounts. Or, you know, when in the 70s, my mother is like a feminist, but she doesn't really know that she's a feminist. She's like a conservative feminist, which is, yeah. But she stopped going to Bank of America. This is like a major bank in the United States. She has boycotted Bank of America since the 70s because she had a friend whose husband had died and they gave her a hard time about accessing her money at Bank of America. And so my mother was like, if you can't be bothered to like help this woman, then I'm never doing business with you. And they like, you know, it's her own form of like social protest. She doesn't see it like that necessarily, but it is. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you look at a show like Mad Men, that's a really great example of, a contemporary look at that time period prior to women being engaging in these kind of consciousness raising things. And, you know, what was really leading up to that of women being sexually harassed in the workplace, even more so having less access to higher paying jobs, which, you know, we'll talk about that some more as well. But really wanting to have greater autonomy in their lives, more agency in their lives, and not be necessarily defined as a mother or a wife, but being themselves.
Like having purpose outside the home, right? Understanding that feminine mystique. And really, you know, like I've started working from home and I really have taken up position of housewife, right? Of like house manager, housewife, and starting just personally to understand how disruptive that is to have the scope of my world be so completely domestic. In some ways, I am so much more empowered, obviously, and have access to such a greater world. But just even in my very small exposure to being confined to this domestic sphere in some ways, I can't even imagine. You know, I can see quote unquote hysteria. But I do, you know, I do want to give props to the second wave because they launched some things that are foundational for what we have. I mean, the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, the push to do that across America, and the vast change that it made in our culture to have a sustained focus on women's rights absolutely laid the base for so many things that came.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you maybe just explain what ERA means?
Sure. It's the Equal Rights Amendment. And so it's actually really similar to the Frauenvolksbegehren in Austria. So that is a women's like popular initiative or like a referendum. But this was supposed to be a change to the U.S. Constitution that would affect like equality for women.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't pass, it passed, but it didn't it wasn't ratified, correct?
So there are two ways to change the Constitution. Yeah. The path they took was you have to have 2/3 of the states ratify the change to the Constitution, and then the amendment is put into the Constitution. So they came up, I think, 3 states short or something. Illinois was the big breaking point. So they passed it in all of these states. And it's very simple. It says equal rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged on account of sex. It's so, I mean, obviously simplistic now when we look at it, but actually the concept itself is radical in its simplicity because they had to organize in so many states, right? If you think about putting that much effort into organizing around an issue of equality in 2/3 of the states of the United States, right? The logical outcome of that is that you have changed the culture in 2/3 of the states of the United States. And that's what it pushes forward. So that movement to organize all of these women around this single issue, and they fell short in Illinois. And like, that was the big breaking point. And when you talk with second wave feminists, like they'll talk about the vote in Illinois and how to them, to the second wave feminists, you know, to our mothers who are still alive, that was their first Hillary lost moment. That was the moment when they first, you know, there's all of this stuff whenever something happens, like about how America lost its innocence. But that was really, you know, that was the first heartbreak. It was really spine breaking to the back of the women's movement when they lost Illinois. And it was a moment after that of kind of, you'll see that the women's movement scattered after that and struggled to collect itself. And I think the Me Too is the first time since the Illinois loss that we have come together in as large a number to make change.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, this is why we have to have individual policies in individual states in order to kind of like implement what was in the ERA, which would have been so simple to add to the Constitution. We've had to create so many other laws that basically legislate that one thing that we could have just had three more states and it would have been, all of this other stuff wouldn't have been necessary.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that we, I think, didn't say is that when we talk about the second wave, that's like 60s, 70s, right? 1960s, 1970s, mostly.
Into the 80s, I would say, even, yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that I know was kind of the, well, maybe the most important issue in the second wave in Europe was abortion rights. And as far as I know, that also was a huge issue in America because Roe versus Wade happened in 1973, right? And that was like a huge moment for the women's movement.
Yeah. Amy, do you want to talk about Jane?
The Jane Collective?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Jane Collective is amazing, an amazing chapter in the history of reproductive rights in the United States. And again, another reason why the second wave feminists were a little bit badass. Like they really took some things into their own hands and said, if this isn't going to be the law, then this is what we're going to do. So the Jane Collective, as abortion began to be further and further restricted, basically it was a group of women who came out of Chicago and they trained themselves how to perform abortions. It was a combined underground movement in Chicago of women who came together and said, fine, if we're not going to be able to access it, we're not going to be sending these women to back alleys. We're not going to be sending them to, you know, butchers, to these guys who are just taking their money and harming them. So they got together and they basically worked with the abortion providers who were kosher, and they just trained themselves as a group how to perform abortions, and they set up a word of mouth underground network. And basically, if you were seeking an abortion and you were able to kind of access this underground network, you would be referred to a woman who could perform the abortion for you. And they, you know, they set up, I think what they did was they rented apartments. So they maintain these sterile, private, sterile, safe spaces for women to go and basically performed off the books abortions for years and years until Roe came around.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And there are two films that are under development for this. One is an indie flick called Ask for Jane. And then the other one is a kind of screenplay called This is Jane that are both about the Jane Collective. You know, there was a lot of other organizing, you know, women who were working, who needed someone to babysit, they put together like babysitting co-ops in like the suburbs so that like the mothers who were staying home with the kids could take care of the kids and the mothers who were working were going out and working. And it wasn't this like, I'm blaming you for not taking care of your kid and you're like just a housewife. It was like, we're all in this fucking together.
Yeah, it really was. It was a moment of radical activism that we're not seeing as much. Like we're not seeing that sort of radical activism anymore. And I don't know if it was because I think that were Roe to become restricted again, we would absolutely see. I think the radical activism would make that look like, you know, gloves and high tea.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and like I said at the beginning with Roe v. Wade, you know, there are states that would have to change, you know, there are 20 states where they would have to absolutely change their laws in order to make abortion legal. Of the 30 states that are not included in that 20, not all of them probably have laws or they would change the law that they've got because they're either liberal states or it's just, I mean, it's unthinkable that they wouldn't have abortion in their state.
And just for the listeners that are not in America, Roe versus Wade was basically a landmark decision in the U.S. Supreme Court that made abortion legal nationwide and kind of overruled individual laws of states. And I think the situation now is that abortion is, like in Austria also, legal within the first 12 weeks of pregnancy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess we'll get into this more when we talk about reproductive rights. But I mean, I think that What's the cutoff in the United States for abortion, Amy?
That's the problem is it's vague right now. Roe just says you cannot put undue burden. That's the standard. Mm-hmm. And so undue burden, that's where the anti-choice activists are finding traction, is coming in at the edges of what undue burden means. Mm-hmm. And right now the big push was for the 20-week ban. That's kind of the number that's being thrown around right now, is this kind of 20-week ban. is what they're trying to what they're trying to pass.
For the most part, we don't really do third trimester abortions in the United States.
It's, I mean, not elective. Most.
Yeah, not elective. Yeah. But like if there's a problem with the mother or the child or like the like, you know, if the child is not viable, is the child is basically going to is I don't want to say it, it sounds grim, but like dead in your womb, like. Some people are happy to, like, give birth to the child, do all of that, and carry it on. I mean, you know, they're better people than I am. Like,
it's so that is, again, a place where the anti-choice activists have really tried to come in at the margins, and they call it, you know, partial birth abortion, which is not a medical term. It's absolutely a branding thing that they have taken up as a publicity campaign. But third trimester abortions, it's ironic that there's so much focus on them because they represent, I think, 1% of all abortions performed, and they are only done out of medical necessity. And, you know, as you can imagine, there is, if you do have, if the fetus is struggling in the womb or is already dead in the womb, the risks to the mother for carrying that are enormous. It is a absolute fallacy to think that, you know, women are just walking into Planned Parenthood and elective aborting at, you know, 8 months into term. And it's offensive, right? It's just a representation of the offensive way that women are portrayed by the anti-choice movement as either, you know, whores or absolutely lacking morals, right? They didn't have enough morals to not have sex in the first place. And now they're still so morally bankrupt that they're just walking in and, you know, abortion on demand in 8 months.
The focus on the unborn life versus the mother's life. And that's obscene. But also this idea of controlling the narrative, controlling the language that we use to talk about these things. You know, this everybody knows the term partial birth abortion and everybody thinks, oh my gosh, that's terrible. That's terrible. But that's not actually a thing. Like,
yeah.
But if you control the language that's used, you have a lot of influence over the way people think about things.
And the idea that, like, wasn't it also the case with Trump during his campaign when he said something like the baby can be pulled out of the mother's womb or something like that, like something stupid like that? I don't really remember what he said exactly, but didn't he also?
That's not happening.
I know, but I mean, I think it's interesting that he also kind of picked up on this issue during his campaign and, you know, just spread complete disinformation about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course he picked up on the issue because he needed to have, like, Christian conservatives vote for a guy who had been, like, divorced twice. You know, he has to convince people that, like, Christian conservatives should vote for him, so.
You know he's left a wake of abortions, like, around the world. Seriously. Like, he's such a...
Allegedly.
An alternative fact is that Donald Trump has, you know, has caused 50 abortions around the world during his lifetime.
Yeah.
It's an alternative fact. It's just an alternative fact.
50. And then that's the exact number. It's 50.
It is 50. I mean, they had a party when they got to it. When they got to it.
So second wave feminism, it made a lot of progress. And then I think a lot of people kind of like sat on that for a while and were like, yeah, we can work now and like we can get these awesome jobs, blah, blah, blah. And then like late 90s, early 2000s, we started really seeing kind of a third wave of feminism coming about. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of Gen Xers, though Gen Xers are so like apathetic.
We're not apathetic. We're just we're cynical. We're extremely cynical. We never got Camelot. All we got was Bill Clinton, you know, and kind of that the anti-people conservatism of Ronald Reagan, and global warming started. I mean, we weren't birthed at the launch of an optimistic millennium, right?
No, that's probably very true.
But
yeah. But, you know, third wave feminism, it starts to be intersectional. It starts to be really, like, everything goes.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. And it was, and it kind of, like, globalism, right? Like, Gen X really started to see globalism start to come around. And I think that's where the intersectionality came in. It's interesting when you look at the intersection of race in America and gender in America and the liberation movements. And we actually, there was enormous progress on race in America in the 70s, enormous progress. And Lyndon Johnson put together a commission to study race in America, and they came up with all of these recommendations for him that actually became implemented throughout America in the 70s. And when you do polling and when you look at just objective measures of where race was in America in the 70s versus where it is now, we were better. We were better on race. There was more opportunity for, and, you know, a lot of times when we talk about race in America, we talk about, you know, Black folk, because that's where our biggest kind of crisis lies and our biggest offense lies. But then the Reagan administration came and really dismantled all of these regulations and commissions and initiatives that had brought us so far on race. And so, you know, Gen X really started after Clinton came around, and mixed though his legacy was, he really did start to open up that conversation again and start to do some of, undo some of the evils of the Reagan era. And so we started having those conversations again about race. And so intersectionality started to come into it, and Black women started to have a, you know, some air to breathe. And, you know, Latinx women started to say, hey, wait, no, I exist too. Race isn't just Black and white. And, you know, the gays were like, wait, what about me? I have a voice too. I'm not as terrified of speaking up, right? So we had all of these people. There was finally some air in the room for some of these people to come up and say, wait, talk about me. You know, when we're talking about liberation, talk about me. And I think Gen X was like, oh, all right. Okay, cool. And then...
Yeah, I think with second wave feminism, you know, especially with the student movements in the 60s and going into the 70s, it was a lot, and, you know, the protests against Vietnam, it was a lot easier to say, like, we need to support people in developing countries, in addition to, like, taking care of people of color at home. And I think once we get into the third wave, it's like, okay, we don't need to just support developing countries. We need to actively do something, and we need to raise money and, like, look at these child soldiers that are over there. You know, there's a lot there, and it kind of just expands, and it is a reaction to what happened in the 80s. Absolutely. But, like, intersectional feminism is the direction we're going in.
Yeah, I don't think there's any going back.
You know, we can't go back.
I mean, that is always the cry of the feminist movement, right? We won't go back. Never another season of silence.
And I think that it's interesting that, like, intersectionality has always been this struggle within the women's movement, within feminist movements, even from the beginning with suffrage and the lack of inclusion of women of color, even though one of the strategies was to piggyback on, like, the suffrage of Black men as granted by the 14th and 15th Amendments. But there have always been women and organizations who have gotten it, who've included women of color. And I think at this moment, we're really seeing a push to include more voices. And it can be hard because consensus building with so many voices and stakeholders is really, really difficult. But it's absolutely worth it.
Yeah. And it's threatening, too, because you're asking oppressed groups, right? You're asking people who don't have as much power to give up some of their power, right? And that's what the ask comes across as feeling like, give me some of your power, give me some of your agency. That's not what it is at all, but that's what it feels like, right? When you have lived with less, it feels like giving something up. When you're asked to compromise, as difficult as the online space is, during the Hillary campaign, there was so much opportunity for women of color and white women to interact, and for women of color to demand their place in the movement, and for white women to get a little bit of education from women of color saying, I'm not asking you to give something up. I'm just asking you to acknowledge my existence and to make me equal in your struggle.
Yeah. And intersectionality, it's not just about including women of color. It's awareness of all intersectional identities, right? Like gender identities, racial identities, cultural identities, class identities, etc. And I think that it's hard for upper middle class, cis white, women bodied feminists who have been fighting the good fight for years to see someone come in and disrupt their thought processes.
Yeah.
But disruption can be really positive. And I think that it's productive and it's good for the movement. It's good for feminism and for the message generally to be open to all of these voices.
Yeah, I think a really concrete example of that discussion that I've seen online is the Pussy Hats and the Women's March. And it really came down to, there was a lot of argument, right? Like, the pink pussy doesn't represent what I look like. I'm a trans activist. It doesn't even represent me at all. And so there was this movement for the second women's march to say, don't make this the symbol of the march. And of course, a lot of women, not just white women, but particularly white women, said, no, wait, this was an organic outcry based on the fact that Donald Trump said, grab him by the pussy. This has nothing to do with, like, we didn't all come together and vote on this as our symbol. This was a grassroots reaction from women and women of color included, who, you know, who said, I'm going to wear this. I'm going to wear who I am on my sleeve. You can't deny me. But really, in some of the more intersectional feminist spaces that I participate in, the consensus became, you know what? None of that matters anymore. If some of our people feel that this symbol actively oppresses them and holds their voice down in the movement, then it's not us. Then we can't participate in it. And giving up a goddamn pussy hat isn't going to stop our movement, you guys. Like,
so what was the thing that was so odd to me is that I got the play on words of like pussy and cat, like vagina being called a pussy, a cat being called a pussy, and it looks like cat ears.
Yeah.
I thought that it was like a play on words, but that is not the case. So I will put it away in my drawer.
Yeah, it is, but, you know, it wasn't. Yeah, and it's hard because again, I really cherish the time and the talks that I have with kind of these second wave feminists. And, you know, the fact that some of these women, no matter how free they were, this was still the first time that they were like, I'm going to wear a pussy hat, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it was just this liberating moment for them. And it was amazing and taking it all back. So intersectionality, I think we know that we're on the right track because it's hard.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and it really shakes things up, but it is hard. And I'm constantly challenged by it. And I don't know where it's going. You know, we don't have, again, because we're such a diaspora of a movement and there are so many voices, we don't have a single leader. We don't have our Dr. King. We don't have our Gloria. We don't have our Susan B. We have all of these women, and maybe it's a different way of taking power and disrupting power, but it's not one that's familiar, you know, but we do have, I think the one thing that we can say is that Black women are finally, you know, of any of the women that I can point to, outside of Hillary really sort of carrying the standard and taking it on the chin for us, it's Black women that have come up, who have started, you know, the mothers of the movement. And the Me Too movement was started by Black women, and the Women's March was led by a coalition of women of color. Yeah. So I think,
well, and even like Black Lives Matters, I mean, there is feminism in Black Lives Matters, because it was mothers of children who had been killed by cops who helped with that movement as well.
Yeah, the mothers of the movement are, the Black Lives Matter is five, I think, well, now the number grows, right? It was three Black women, and then it was four, and now it's five, and I think it's six. And so it's really these women that we should have been listening to all along, who are, in some ways, finally being elevated.
Yeah, which is good. I mean,
yeah, so I think we're going to talk about the current political situation later. But since we now talked about like the feminist movement, plural, in the US up to this point, I think maybe it's also a good idea to get into some like facts and figures about the state of women's rights at the moment in the US. And why don't we tell our listeners a few things about reproductive rights and healthcare?
We've already talked about reproductive rights, but what else is there besides Roe v. Wade? Is Roe v. Wade really in danger of being overturned? And is abortion covered by insurance in the United States?
So Roe v. Wade, it's an interesting question about Roe, because what we've seen is the gradual chipping away of Roe. And everything is always possible, and I could absolutely see anti-choice people sending it up the chain and trying to actually finally dismantle Roe. What that would mean in terms of a grassroots outcome, it may, you know, you may see a movement to put an amendment in the Constitution I could definitely see women's rights organizations working on a two-thirds amendment into the Constitution to enshrine it.
But if we couldn't get the ERA passed, I mean, to be fair, I guess 30 states already would be on board with it, already have laws on the books that allow for abortion in some way. So it would just be a matter of getting, you know, a couple more.
Yeah. And it would be really interesting to see the grassroots effect, because even though abortion is still a hot button issue, the support for Planned Parenthood is so entrenched, and it is a way that so many women access healthcare. Like, for so many women, Planned Parenthood or their local reproductive provider is their sole source of healthcare, right? It's how they access healthcare. So the danger to Roe, I think the much bigger danger to Roe is chipping away, is the 20 things like the 20-week ban. And then you have, and then they say they move it to an 18-week ban, and then they move it to a 15-week ban, or even access. I mean, what good is a right if you can't exercise it? And you'll see, like in Texas, you know, sometimes you have to drive 4 hours, and then they put in a 1-day waiting period. If you're a low-income woman and you need an abortion and you have to drive 4 hours to get your appointment, and then you probably have to stay overnight to go back for a second appointment, right? And then your appointment isn't for a week later.
And it may not be covered by insurance, so all of that cost is on you. We talked about this with regard to Austria. In Austria, within the first trimester, it is not punishable, but it's still...
Wow.
Technically, like, anything after that is technically like illegal, and it costs like 500 euro to get an abortion most of the time. So in a lot of areas, they, you know, there are doctors who just won't perform them. So, and you have to travel, you know, maybe to the city. If you live in the countryside, you have to travel to the city to get it. It's a very similar situation to that.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, how much we even have of Roe anymore is so determinant based on your geography. If you're in North Dakota, if you are in, you know, Appalachia, if you're in some of these areas, you know, Kansas, you may not be able to access an abortion provider. And the cost, like, there are a lot of funding mechanisms to fund low-income abortions. But again, there's the Hyde Amendment that says no government dollars can go to abortion.
And this is a recent amendment.
Hyde Amendment has been around since the 80s. Okay. I think it was passed in the late 80s, early 90s. It passed out of the Senate, but it really is, it, you know, basically creates an accounting issue.
Yeah.
You know, for folks in Planned Parenthood said, fine, none of those dollars will go for abortions, but federal dollars are still keeping the doors open for a lot of these agencies. And it is the only source of healthcare for so many women. But again, like, if you can't access it, what good is a right?
Absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit about this access to public healthcare, because, I mean, I think low-income women are affected disproportionately. In the United States, we have Medicaid, which is the public health insurance program for low-income people in the United States, and it pays for 3/4 of all publicly supported women's health programs. And it also helps fund access to clinics throughout the U.S., Planned Parenthood included. And as laws are being passed at the state level to stop providing Medicaid money to organizations that provide abortions, this means that organizations like Planned Parenthood are seeing a lot of their funding disappear. And so one example of how this has worked has been in Iowa. In May of last year, 2017, the Republican governor signed a bill defunding Planned Parenthood. Medicaid dollars stopped flowing to the group on July 1st, and 4 of the state's Planned Parenthood clinics closed within a week. And that left about 15,000 people in small communities without access to reproductive health services, including cancer screenings, you know, like pap smears, birth control, testing for and treatment of STDs, and annual checkups. And by the way, STDs are way on the rise in the United States.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. But ironically, according to Elizabeth Nash, a public policy analyst at the Guttmacher Institute, without Planned Parenthood clinics, the use of contraception will likely decline and abortion rates will likely rise. So,
right. So like here in Colorado, the legislature passed an IUD bill. And basically, like, there was this test program that they did where for, I think it was 2 years, you could get a free IUD, and tons of women took advantage of it. And birth rates went down, abortion rates went down, maternal mortality went down. The public health outcomes were stunning. They were,
yeah.
Everything worked exactly the way the pro-choice folks knew it always would if you increase access to contraception. But lo and behold, when the Republicans got a hold of the Senate, they took the program away.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right. All of these all of these anti-choice, quote unquote, pro-life people took away funding and dismantled a program that was reducing abortions.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the wider use of contraceptives accounted for a 14% drop in the U.S., like nationwide U.S. abortion rate between 2011 and 2014, and a reduction in the rate of unplanned pregnancies as well. So, like, it's a no-brainer. Like, even if you don't want to fund abortions, at least give Planned Parenthood the money that they need to be able to provide for the other services, and that is going to actually decrease the number of abortions, yeah, even necessary.
Right. But it's not about abortion. No. Because, like, the reason why it's so hilarious in a terrible way is that it's not about abortion. It's about controlling the means of reproduction, and it's about controlling women's bodies and controlling women. And through that, controlling women of color, particularly.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about this a lot this morning, and it's just profoundly hypocritical that the Republican Party, which claims to be against government intervention in personal liberties, has been so captured by this kind of social and Christian conservative movement that they believe that they have the right to say what adults, particularly adult women, can do with their bodies. And this is not just about abortion. This is about birth control, health care, and all sorts of other things.
Well, and like the gays, right? The people who are all about rugged autonomy and I do what I please are all about regulating gay rights.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with individual liberty. It has everything to do with social control.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the church as an agent of social control has a profound history throughout civilization.
Yeah. I mean, and in the US, you know, we don't actually, it's really different from Austria, because Austria has been like a Catholic country for so long.
Yeah.
The United States has really always been this like puritanical, evangelical, Protestant run. I mean, we have, don't get me wrong, we have,
I know,
but it's mostly these kind of evangelicals that have like either very strict interpretations of the Bible or who think that the United States should be a Christian country. And it's just not. I mean, yes, to some extent, the United States was founded on Judeo-Christian values of hard work and this kind of rugged individualism type thing. But really, we have separation of church and state. We have literally, our country was founded on not having a state religion, that religion and the state be totally separate. And I think it's interesting that, you know, there are a lot of conservatives who are fiscal conservatives. You know, they've got their own set of issues. For the most part, they just don't want the government paying for stuff that like individuals should pay for, or that the states should be taking care of, you know, or things like that.
Or a very, very current issue is also the, you know, the whole debate surrounding guns and the regulations thereof, which is also very
Second Amendment. Well, that's like a whole nother
thing. When you talked about how conservatives want to kind of defend individual like freedoms and on the other hand regulate women's bodies that much, I had to think about a tweet that I came across. I don't know which woman wrote it, but I can't give a credit now because I don't remember the name, but she was like, you know, one way to get Republicans to regulate guns is put them in our vaginas, you know?
Sad, but true. But yeah, so, you know, we have these fiscal conservatives and even libertarians who are very different from the Christian conservatives in the party. And like, but they've been totally captured by that part of the party to the extent that if you were truly believing in Republican stuff of like the government getting out of my bedroom and the government getting out of my home and the government regulating less in my life, then you should be all for the government not passing laws that control my body.
Right.
Completely. Yeah.
But that's not where we're at. So reproductive rights is one aspect of women's issues in the United States, but not all women reproduce. But what is important is healthcare. And there's a lot of issues surrounding healthcare in the United States. We have a really different system than most of Europe, than most other countries, actually.
I don't understand it at all.
Nobody does.
To be honest, I just don't understand it.
So most of our insurance is through our jobs.
Yeah.
The Affordable Care Act changed that somewhat so that you could buy on like a market. You could always buy private insurance, but it was usually pretty expensive. And so then the Affordable Care Act created a marketplace whereby you could buy insurance theoretically that was like more affordable because there was like leveraging power of like the people who were all buying off of this marketplace. Amy actually had insurance, has insurance through the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, absolutely. the Affordable Care Act was revolutionary for so many people. We tell women to stay home and take care of their children, and yet we, you know, we only provide insurance through jobs, right? So we mandate, usually the mandate is that it's through this heterosexual model where the man goes off and has the job and will provide health insurance for you. Or the next option is a woman has a job that will provide health insurance, but this is highly specific to white collar workers. You know, like you can buy insurance, Starbucks, right? Some of the bigger, more progressive companies will allow you to buy insurance. It's still not affordable in any way if you're making an hourly wage like that. But, you know, Medicare was really this stopgap for this broken system where we mandated a certain kind of employment in order to have access to healthcare. But that also didn't, you know, again, it was stopgap because there were so many gaps, right? It was like, what about people who are unemployed? What about people who have a pre-existing condition? What about people who are basically uncoverable? You know, an insurance company won't even touch them.
So my dad had cancer. He got prostate cancer. He had to stay at his job long enough that he could get the treatment and then switch. And while he was at his job, switch to an insurance that he could maintain, like that he could transfer after he retired, that he didn't have to get a whole new physical. And so he stayed on Kaiser, which is this one kind of healthcare system in the United States, so that he would have a seamless transition and that he wouldn't have a gap in coverage because, you know, he couldn't have Medicare, which is like the pensioners insurance, essentially, in the United States, like old people. That's the way to explain it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, oh, I mean, God, because my dad knew that he had a pre-existing condition, he had to make arrangements to make sure that he could have health care.
Right.
And I think a lot of women, if they have, these are things that like single moms really, really have to think about, especially if they're working single moms, they have to think about not only childcare for their children, but they also have to think about how their kids are going to get healthcare.
As with any sort of public policy issue that affects people poorly, the impacts of those effects fall disproportionately on women and women of color, right? So it just, all of the struggles with healthcare in the United States are, you know, it's a hand on women's liberation, and it is a hand keeping them from having full economic equality, which is a huge engine for achieving social equality.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so difficult to understand for like European ears, because like where I live in Austria, we just have public insurance, you know. As soon as, I mean, basically everyone has health insurance, and you don't have to, like when you have a job, you pay tax, and that goes to your health insurance. But also when you're unemployed and get unemployment benefit, you're also insured automatically. So it's just so different, and it's so hard to understand that like a country in 2018 would not have public health insurance. I don't know. It's just something that I absolutely don't get. I don't understand, you know, the organization of healthcare in America, and I don't understand, or health insurance in America, and I don't understand why there's so much also resistance to it, because, you know, a lot of people seem to think that it takes away their freedom to have health insurance.
You know, I had a friend who for years didn't have insurance because she was like relatively healthy and she didn't want to spend the money on it. I mean, some of it has to do with people in the U.S. don't like paying taxes. A lot of people in the United States don't like paying taxes. And so, you know, to pay another tax on top of the taxes that we're already paying, like that's one thing. But yes, it's a personal choice whether you want to be insured or not. But if I want insurance, I should have a really easy way to get it.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But imagine, I mean, it's pretty easy to trace the origins. Imagine all of the private wealth that would be lost if we shut down major insurance corporations, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then pharmaceuticals would fall under a single payer system, and those would become regulated. All of the private wealth that would be lost, that's really who we're fighting against here. As much as it is the taxpayers who say, well, I don't want to have to pay for, you know, your cancer treatment if you smoked your whole life. You know, it's those folks. But then it is also the other pressure on it is, you know, Blue Cross and Cigna and these private insurers that are just making money hand over fist on the American public health crisis, because America is in the middle of a public health crisis.
And there are a lot of aspects to that public health crisis. And I, you know, honestly, I would say that the gun issue is also part of our public health crisis. I mean, people are dying. People are dying at alarming rates in the United States because of guns. And I don't care. I don't care whether it's guns that are committed in crimes or guns that are brought to like schools and people are shooting up schools, like all of it. All of it is a public health crisis. I don't care who it affects.
Yeah.
So the healthcare thing, as I said, Planned Parenthood provides a lot of cancer screenings, birth control, testing for a lot of different things. It's not just about, you know, our healthcare crisis isn't just about insurance in the United States. And it's not just about abortion. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention said that 17% of people in the U.S. don't have a usual source for healthcare.
Oh, that's horrible.
Which means they probably don't have a primary care doctor. It may be that they live in a rural area and the doctor's too far away, or they don't want to go to the doctor. But women actually do better in this regard than men. In 2014, 2015, only 12% of all U.S. women had no usual source for healthcare. And for men, it's about 22%. You know, I, having a husband, I know he doesn't like to go to the doctor and he doesn't like to have like deal with that stuff. But like, that's a stereotype, right? I mean,
yeah.
But it also means that they're receiving care at clinics or on an emergency basis, which is why Planned Parenthood is so important. If these people have chronic health conditions, they're not being treated for them. And the numbers aren't really broken down within race categories by gender in the report, but generally 20% of indigenous peoples do not have access to healthcare. So that's any tribes within the United States or indigenous people in Alaska as well. 18% of African Americans do not go to a regular healthcare provider. And 27% of individuals who identify as Mexican do not have a regular doctor. And this, I mean, honestly, isn't surprising because they may not have the money. Their legal status in the United States may be in question. And they're actually afraid of going to the doctor because they think that they're going to be turned in and deported.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, it's not just... It's a bigger problem, a multifaceted problem.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to solve the issues of the world right here, but it's a multifaceted problem and it's an intersectional problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And one other thing, and we've talked about this on some of our other episodes about having children, pregnant bodies. Maternal mortality in the United States is appalling.
And it's on the rise.
It's on the rise.
Yeah, it's on the rise.
Absolutely.
And it's like compared to other industrialized, first world industrialized nations, it's almost inexplicable, the margin.
Oh, yeah. So the U.S. has the worst maternal mortality rate among developed nations. Per 100,000 live births, it's 26.4 mothers die. And since 2000, this number has increased from about 17 deaths to this 26. So it's increased like significantly in the last, you know, 18 years. Elsewhere, like Germany, Ireland, and Finland, the maternal mortality rate has been on decline. So in Germany in 2016, it was 9 mothers in 100,000. Ireland, it's 4.7. Finland, it's 3.8.
Wow.
So some of this has been the focus on the child rather than on the mother. Infant mortality is at the lowest point in history, which is great. And some people point to the fact that we focus so much on reducing infant mortality that maternal mortality has really fallen by the wayside. And again, this is all contingent on folks having insurance to be able to be cared for in the first place.
And if you go back to our episode on pregnant bodies, Heather talked about that a lot. She talks about mortality, the mortality rate in America for mothers, but also about her own experience with the healthcare system when she gave birth.
Well, and look, let's point to a contemporary example of something that just happened. Serena Williams just had a baby. And she knows that she's prone to clotting, and she didn't feel quite right. And so she said something to the doctor about it, and they tried to ignore her, and she had to like push it. She had say, like, look, I think there's something wrong. Like, this is a problem that I have in my body. This needs to be taken seriously.
And if that's something that happens to Serena Williams, then
sweet Jesus,
imagine not being famous and having to give birth.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, God, there's so much more. So sad.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about equal pay. Just why not? Or the lack thereof.
Equal pay. And I'm not, I mean, everything in the U.S. is, we're such this weird bubble. And it's hard to imagine going somewhere. It's hard to imagine living in a society where women are paid and valued equally, right? It's just, it's hard to get out of that. Like, it's what I've always grown up with. It's what I've always known. It's hard to imagine it ever being different. And that's mm-hmm. part of the problem, right? If you can, it's very 1984. If you can control my imagination and my reality, you can control what the future looks like around it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the first most obvious thing to point out about the equal pay gap in America, and white women are up to about 78 cents on the dollar, is that once you go down to, mm-hmm. you know, black women, I think are at 64 cents on the dollar. Undocumented women are, I think, at 52 cents on the dollar.
Ugh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Hispanic women generally are at 54, yeah. black women at 62. Yeah.
So it just, you know, it's like mm-hmm. all of that impact just kind of trickles down the chain to the less power you have, the less money you have, the less money you have, the less power you have. And it is this pernicious cycle. And what's encouraging or frustrating is that so many people in America are in support of equal pay for women because it's affecting them, right? If you ask most women's husbands who have any kind of head on their shoulders if their wife should be paid less, they say no, right? Like, you're taking food out of my kid's mm-hmm. mouth if you're paying my wife less. And so yeah. the support for equal pay is there, but it's one of those things that it's easy to legislate and hard to regulate. With so many private employers in America and, you know, so much focus on, you know, there's not an open culture of salary sharing in America that's changing, right? One of the things millennials are doing is demanding a lot more transparency in so many venues of mm-hmm. life. Because they're used to it, right? Like mm-hmm. millennials have grown up knowing everything about everyone. And then they get into these old school situations where people want to control information and they're not buying it. So, you know, so that could be, yeah. that could be helpful as we move forward in the equal pay on that regulation end. But it's still, yeah, it's still, we're just paying women less and expecting more.
In my husband's office years ago, somebody accidentally left the salaries like spreadsheet on the printer, which, you know, in the 90s, early 2000s was like a huge deal because they didn't have that kind of transparency. Like nobody, you know, nobody wanted anybody else to know how much other people were making. But I think we're getting to a point where that kind of transparency is important and people are having to be held accountable. Right now, average pay gap is about 20%, but regardless of whether in each industry, it's, you know, what the pay difference is in each industry, I think we can safely say that women are across the board paid less than men. If it's 20% or not, you know, that, you know, let's not haggle over numbers. Like, women are paid less than men, period. You know, the American Association of University Women has tried to explain this in different ways. One of the ways they say is occupation and choice. Women and men often choose different majors if they go to college and different jobs after college. Women are disproportionately represented in jobs about education, office and administrative support, healthcare occupations, which are these kind of pink collar jobs that we often associate with women.
Mm-hmm.
And men are often taking jobs that are more quote unquote manly. And so that self-segregation can be a major factor. But what ends up happening is, and this is so, so interesting, as women go into jobs that are more male dominated, the salary in those jobs ends up decreasing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which
yeah, yeah.
is nuts.
And it also, I don't know if that's also true for the US, but in Austria, we also have that phenomenon the other way around, that jobs that were traditionally done by women, when men enter those fields, they suddenly are paid more,
right.
valued more, and they get more money for that, which is so interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Right. It's just, it's another illustrative factor that it is not about the skill. It is not about anything
except
keeping women in a specific place. And because of the pay gap, yeah. you know, the majority of people living in poverty in the United States are women, right?
Yeah.
And it you know, if you're making 20% less, it's so much, if you're living on the margins and you're already making 20% less, how much easier is it to fall into poverty?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And oftentimes poverty is extremely hard on the family unit. And when the family unit breaks down, it's the women who end up taking care of the kids. And it's the women who are already making yeah. less money who now have the burden of providing more.
Well, and mm-hmm. I've seen this with some of my friends who have kids. You know, the cost of childcare is so expensive that it actually doesn't make financial sense for the woman to go back to work because she doesn't make enough to make up that gap for childcare. I mean, leaving aside the fact that it's good for her, like, emotional stability to not have to be around kids all day.
Mm-hmm.
Forget about that. Like, it's not.
Right. The irony being that who are the childcare providers? Women. Right.
Yes.
And like the rising cost of childcare is bad, but at the same time, it's we're hopefully paying women more who are providing childcare.
Absolutely. Like, you want to be paying these people who are caring for your children a fair and decent wage because they're the people who are taking care of your children.
Right. Right. Which, you know, so it circles back around a cost of living in the United States and accessibility of housing. If you are asking for childcare in an urban core like Chicago, New York, San Francisco, Seattle, right? Some of these urban cores, these people need to be making a living wage who are providing care for your child. But at the same time, you need to be making a wage to pay them. So it's so incredibly interconnected. It's difficult.
Yeah. And for those people who argue to you, oh, well, that 20% pay gap, that's taking into account people are working part-time and like people who have left the job market to have children and come back, etc. American Association of University Women, accounting for college major, occupation, economic sector, hours worked, months of unemployment since graduation, GPA, type of undergraduate institution, all of that. They still found that there was a 7% difference between the earnings of male and female college graduates 1 year after graduation. And that gap jumped to 12% over 10 years after college graduation. So even if you want to say it's 12%, even if you want to say, you know, as time goes on, that gap continues to widen because women aren't getting the raises, or the raises are percentage. And so they're not getting as much of a raise because they're already at a disadvantage.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that is a huge problem in Austria is that due to the fact that women earn less, there is this huge gap when it comes to pensions. So women, there's a 40% pension gap. Can you tell us a bit about the situation of older women in America? There's also no public pension system, right?
Technically.
There's Social Security.
Okay.
But Social Security, what you get paid out of Social Security is based on what you put into Social Security. So the huge irony is that women have been putting less into Social Security over the course of their career.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just they are being robbed of of their equal pay throughout their lives. And then when at a time when they are vulnerable, that thievery comes around in full again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they'd be on a fixed income. If they invested something, they might have that. But, you know, if you work a lower income job for your entire life and you paid into the Social Security system, you're not getting a lot out. There is kind of anecdotal stories that I could tell about, you know, a woman who owned her home, but because she couldn't afford to pay the taxes on her home, they basically kicked her out of her home because, you know, you still have to continue to pay property taxes on your house. And even though you paid however much over the course of 30 years to own your home, you know, if you can't pay the taxes because you're on a fixed income, you'd lose your home.
Okay.
I don't know if this is true or if this is just kind of whatever, but in the United States, they had to make sure that pet food was safe for human consumption because older people who have pets would often eat their animals' food so that they could have food.
Right. So they could pay for their prescription drugs.
Oh, God.
Right. That was, that was like the story that came out, right? Is like people were choosing, seniors were choosing between prescription drugs, the cost of which is exorbitant for some of these necessary drugs. And so they were like, you know what I can do? Fancy Feast is 50 cents a can.
Oh, my God.
This is a poverty issue more generally, but because more women are in poverty and women live longer than men, and this is a women's issue.
Yeah, completely. God, I'm so shocked by the dog food thing because I have a cat. I know what cat food smells like and I didn't want to eat it.
Yeah.
No, it's disgusting.
It's horrible. Yeah.
Shockingly, the pro-life movement is silent.
Old people's lives don't matter.
Right, Fetus lives matter.
Yeah.
Hashtag fetus lives matter.
Yeah, I mean, old people have lived long lives. Just let them wither.
And die, I mean,
whatever.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Women live longer, so they have more health problems at end of life because most of the money that you end up paying for healthcare is end of life care. My mother and grandmother-in-law, I guess she is, needed a knee replacement. She is like 98 years old. She needed this knee replacement at like 70 something or like 80 something. So they did the one knee replacement. By the time she got around to needing the second knee replacement, they wouldn't do it because she was too old. She wouldn't have the knee replacement for long enough for it to be like worth it financially for them to pay for it.
Oh, God.
Yep.
This is insane. This is insanity.
But, you know, all lives matter, except for old people.
Women. And
like, women, people of color. Yeah. And, you know. Anyway.
Yeah.
Speaking of sexual discrimination. Yeah, I mean, it's a form of sexual discrimination. I mean, we talk about like the pay gap. That's a form of sexual discrimination. Mm. Yeah. I mean, but in the workplace. I mean, and we have laws that prohibit this. Like, that we're not supposed to be discriminated against based on, like, gender or whatever. Like, there are equal opportunity laws in place, but it doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, this is all so depressing. I hope listeners have a lot of chocolate at their disposal at the moment, because, ugh. So one thing I would like to also talk about, although that makes it even more depressing, is the issue of domestic abuse, like domestic violence, intimate partner abuse, all of that, because we also talked a lot about that in our last episode. And I mean, in the US, I suppose there's also this intersection with gun violence that is different from most countries in Europe. So yeah, Liz, tell us something about that.
Yeah, I mean, intimate partner abuse and abuse of women generally. I mean, if you don't value women, it's really easy to abuse them. You know, when we live in a society that seems, I mean, for me, it's really difficult because I'm not a mother, mm-hmm. and we have this kind of fetishization of motherhood in the United States, even though, you know, obviously we have a maternal mortality problem. But as a married woman, you know, I have more value theoretically because I'm married and mm-hmm. I belong to somebody, even though that's not how my relationship with my husband is. Intimate partner abuse is a clear result of patriarchy mm-hmm. and reinforcing who has the power in our society.
Yeah, it's just, it's such a visible growth of toxic masculinity.
Yep.
It's, if you set up a system where power is limited and power is defined in specific ways, and it's a zero-sum game, violence is the most immediate way to control and maintain power. And, mm-hmm. you know, we do threaten men with lack of power.
Mm-hmm.
Toxic masculinity is this outgrowth of you are this certain way. And once you're not this certain way, you will lose power. And look at women. Do you want to be like, no man wants to be treated like a woman. No white man wants to be treated like people of color, right? So they are extremely invested. They see how terrible it is to be these oppressed classes. And so they're extremely invested, and it is extremely threatening to take away that power. So domestic abuse is a way to institutionalize that power. And it happens across the board. You know, you can't say it's only limited to people of a certain socioeconomic status or those things all exacerbate triggers for violence. It really intersects with the gun violence issue, because if you are a woman in the United States subject to domestic violence, the chances that you will be shot to death are exponentially increased if there's a gun present in the home, right? Like 50 women a month are shot to death in the United States by a domestic partner or by a man that they know. And it is a man. The incidence of women shooting other women in domestic incidences, whether it's partner violence or whether it's your mother or your sister, are almost statistically insignificant for the purposes of this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence says so far this year, I mean, we're recording on the 23rd of February, there have already been 91 gun-related domestic violence fatalities. 10 million people a year are physically abused by an intimate partner.
Right. It's all about control. It's like this, the Me Too movement is, and sexual harassment. We're coming up on all of these questions about men who are just so horrified because they don't understand the boundaries of consent anymore. And they're just, it's hilarious because these men are so terrified of doing something wrong, right? No, you're not terrified of doing something wrong. You're terrified of getting caught doing something wrong.
Yeah.
Right. But it's just that intersection of, I use sex as a form of power, and you denying me sex is a form of you taking power.
You know what's so fucking crazy about this is, so I study the 19th century Like my research is on 19th century, like gender and sexuality in Europe, but like generally, and we've had this like crisis of masculinity since the fucking like 18th century, before that even, like into the medieval time, like in medieval period, we have had these like crises of masculinity where men were like, oh, I'm not really sure, like blah, blah, blah. Or like men who were expressed their feelings or were willing to be submissive in relationships, who, you know, had stronger wives. Society for hundreds of years has basically told these men, like, there's something wrong with you. Mm. Be a man. Stand up for yourself. Be strong, you know, whatever. And if you're not, then you're weak and you're an ineffectual man. You're not even really a man, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. When is this going to stop? Obviously, this discourse is not working for us. This is mm-hmm. not helping our society. Western society is this productive. It's killing me. Like, it's mm-hmm. so awful.
I mean, I guess it's sort of a form of, even though it is awful, it's the best outcome for the people who do have the power, right? If you're a white, heterosexual, cisgender man in the Western world, it's not that bad, right? Like, you can't cry at the kittens and, you know, the kitten bowl or whatever. But on the other hand, you're not worried about being raped all the time. And
yeah, sure.
Right. So it's like, who does win? Who wins in this like assignment of certain attributes to gender roles?
Yeah.
You know, it could be like this, if we had this massive movement to give up this zero sum game around power inequality. And of course, it's tied in with like money, capitalism. I mean, I guess I would say that capitalism and commerce wins. That's mm-hmm. all. I have my own questions around socialism and whether or not, like, in a patriarchal world, we could ever have like a socialist revolution that's ever like a thing that will happen, or if we're too living in the matrix. You can't see.
There's no outside this.
Yeah,
system.
Right. But, you know, hey, this is coming from the lesbian separatist feminist. So, like, I got the answer, you guys. It's easy. Y'all just, like, figure it out.
Just listen to Amy.
Yeah, I'm happy over here. Erin and I are just, like, in our own damn utopia, right? I mean, Dalton, we got a guy. We got Dalton. We got our dog. And he's pretty happy.
Oh.
I just gotta say, he's a pretty happy dude. He's very sensitive. He's a very sensitive man.
Oh, does he cry about kittens?
No, you know, mostly his biggest issue is he has a lot of ennui. I think he just is constantly wondering why.
Yeah, I get that.
This is going to be a really weird reference, but I was watching The Family Feud for like 5 minutes yesterday. They were doing the final. Beatrice doesn't know what Family Feud is.
But no, yeah. No, oh, I'm so sorry. About. You need to watch Family Feud. Like, it is amazing.
It's an American cultural, like, Anyway, one of the questions in the final feud thing was, on a scale of 1 to 10, what percent of men say that they talk about their feelings? How often do you talk about your feelings, like on a scale of 1 to 10? The two African-American women who were doing that part, one of them said 6 and one of them said 5. And the answer was 1.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Men interviewed saying, how much do you talk about your feelings on like a scale of 1 to 10? These women were like 5, 6 area. And the guys were like, nope, 1. I don't talk about my feelings.
Oh, great. Self-reporting, right? Like women's experience. They're like, no, I live in the house with you, dude. And they were probably vastly underreporting. If you actually interact with men do have feelings and they do try to express them. And yeah, it's just who wins? Nobody wins. Toxic masculinity. Nobody wins.
Well, and that comes to the way that we socialize boys. I mean, mm-hmm. if we tell boys like, don't hit like a girl, don't run like, don't do this like a girl. Like, oh, okay. I mean, we've had a lot of messaging for young girls about how there's nothing wrong with hitting like a girl and like being a girl is good and all of these things. And yet we're still talking to these boys about devaluing women.
Mm.
And if you socialize boys to devalue women from the start, then we shouldn't be surprised when as adults they devalue women.
Right. Mm-hmm. Shout out here to the second wave, getting it right, like Barbara Ehrenreich, Hearts of Men. I mean, she, you know, she put her thumb on it right away. We can't just liberate one sector. You know, you talk about Black feminism and the resistance there is my liberation cannot come after somebody else's. I can't wait for it. And it's a really interesting conversation about like, how do we liberate men?
Mm-hmm.
And
I absolutely agree. Do you guys know about the Representation Project?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They did the documentary Misrepresentation, mm-hmm. which is kind of talking about women's representation and girls' representation in media. Mm-hmm. But they also did a film called The Mask You Live In, talking about these issues of boys and how we socialize boys and this really narrow definition of masculinity that we have in the United States and how do we change that?
Yeah.
The first thing is to start the conversation about it.
Mm. Actually, what Amy just said should be our tagline. Toxic masculinity, nobody wins.
Yeah.
Nobody wins.
So positive.
Yeah. I think My Favorite Murder has the like, toxic masculinity ruins the party again.
Exactly.
Right. But it does, like, it gets right into the Me Too movement. It gets right into discrimination mm-hmm. and harassment and men finally, honestly saying, I don't know what the rules are. Which is a, you know, mm-hmm. it's a starting point for a conversation. And I think we, you know, saying to men, no, this isn't acceptable anymore. You need to figure a way to make this work and you need to figure out how to be, and we're here to help you. But you performing your fear on me is no longer acceptable.
Yeah.
And it, again, the history of the Me Too movement is, and sexual harassment and discrimination coming to the fore and making progress. Again, we have Black women to thank for making that a movement. And that goes back to, you know, Anita Hill was a woman in the United States who accused her boss, who was up for nomination to the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas. She came forward and during his Senate confirmation hearings, she came forward and said, he sexually harassed me. And there was a huge, there was a ton of coverage around it in the United States. And she was treated terribly. She was belittled. She was mocked for speaking her truth. But, you know, like it was this Black woman who came forward and was the tip of the spear. And so much, like, there was a huge wave, a huge reinvigoration of the feminist movement after Anita Hill, because it was covered on television. And so many women, it was the first Me Too, so many women experienced what she had and saw how she was treated mm-hmm. and said, enough. I am joining the feminist mm-hmm. movement. This is nuts. I'm tired of being made to feel as though I'm crazy. I am not crazy. The system is broken. And it was a huge energizing movement. Flash forward to, you know, the founders of the Me Too movement and the, yeah. you know, and it really was the working mm-hmm. women who came forward, the blue collar working women who came forward and said, this isn't right. We're not going to have this anymore. And it really started to spill out and magnify.
And blue collar women are the ones most at risk for like losing their job for speaking up about it. But it's so mm-hmm. important for their peace of mind, for their daily lives to be able to say like, this happened to me and it's not right.
Yeah. I mean, just mm-hmm. the threat of psychic violence that is omnipresent for women is if you can't understand how that spills over into every area of your life and how it completely holds down who you are and what your potential is as a human to contribute, we are so robbing the world of all of this human capital by having this like psychic violence towering over women all of the time. And it's really interesting the fact that Hollywood was this flashpoint, this place that's known to be this liberal bastion. And we've all known what a terrible place it is for women for so long. But, you know, it's these men mm-hmm. who vote right and men who give money to the Democratic Party. And the Weinsteins gave so much money to the Democratic Party. And the fact that he mm-hmm. was one of the most prolific,
worst perpetrators.
Violent perpetrators.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. There's so much to talk about.
But then you have other men who are apologists for them in a lot of ways. And you're like, just shut your mouth. Mm-hmm. Just stop talking mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. what you're saying right now is idiotic. Yeah. Like, shut your mouth. Like, this is not your time to speak.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Terry Crews, that poor guy, he was sexually harassed and people have just been like, I mean, he was groped by some dude at a party and now people don't want to talk about Terry Crews. If we can't understand that this is all about power, this has nothing. Terry Crews is a big guy, like a huge guy, muscular guy, like last person you would think who's going to be sexually harassed. And he was sexually harassed. This isn't about sex.
Oh, no.
This isn't about physical, you know, necessarily physical power. This is about emotional, social capital and power and exerting that power over other people.
Mm. Yeah.
Do we want to talk about the current political climate?
Yeah. Since we're already talking about Me Too, I was thinking we could just get into the current situation.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh my God. It is.
How do you feel like we are in the United States right now?
What a time to be alive, right? Like,
oh yeah.
I can't imagine that there won't be some retrospective history on this particular time in the United States history that doesn't identify it as pivotal, for good or for worse, right? I think there are equally opposing forces driving the United States right now. I think women's liberation, there are massively good things are happening and we are moving forward, and we won't know what the policy ramifications and the social ramifications of that are for, I think, a long time as we wait for the cultural issues to settle out. But I do think it is an enormous push forward, which of course is always followed by a proportional backlash.
Pushback.
Right. So so terrifying. The thought of what the backlash against this might be is terrifying. Or on the other hand, are we optimistic in saying, no, we're going to have a revolutionary breakthrough. And, you know, now is a time of taking power and moving the needle permanently on where we are. What terrifies me about that maybe not coming true is that we're also facing these enormous economic pressures where with the disappearing middle class in the United States and kind of our slow slide into becoming a second world country as, you know, productivity wanes and other countries are on the rise. Economic pressures are never a good thing for equality.
I mean, a lot of those things. What I find so interesting about this time that we're living in is that it's not just an American thing, but this contrast between like having a very right-wing government and on the other hand, like new social movements coming up. That's something that also happens in Europe at the moment. And that's what I find so fascinating, that this is kind of a parallel development. We talked about this last time when we talked about Austria, because we also have a very right-wing government now. But then on the other hand, also like what looks like a new feminist movement forming. And I just find that very fascinating.
I mean, I think, you know, we've seen a significant increase in the number of women running for office.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that is really positive. I think that speaks to representation, but it also speaks to a lot of those women are actually winning those races.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that what we saw in the 2016 election, for a lot of women, it was really embarrassing.
Yeah.
For white women, it was embarrassing that they were part of that. And I think that now that we're, you know, a year plus in, people are really doing some deep soul searching, thinking about where they're at. I think that the negative approval numbers, what do you call it? Disapproval numbers? We don't even call them disapproval numbers in the United States, but the poor approval numbers on the part of the president show that, like, you know, we're moving in a direction where people are saying, like, yeah, that wasn't a great decision.
Yeah. Yeah. As a non-American, I remember vividly the day of the election, because I was sure that Hillary Clinton's going to win. And I remember being so heartbroken about her not winning. And I couldn't deal for a few weeks. I felt so depressed about it. And, and I've heard from so many women who felt the same way, because there you had this extremely qualified woman who was maybe the most qualified candidate that ever ran for president. And also the first woman who ever even had a chance to win. And then you have this clown, I don't even know how to put it in words, and he wins against her. And that was such a slap in the face.
I mean, it's playing the odds to some extent. I mean, working the electoral college to your advantage, that, you know, that's part of it. But
yeah,
I think he played on a lot of people's fears. And I think that ultimately that was successful, unfortunately. The issue now is that people can't feel disheartened by it. They have to feel energized by it. And they have to work locally to make changes, get involved with women's organizations locally, get involved with women's issues that they think are important to them, get involved politically, run for office, run for local office. Those are things that are really important, because the only way that we start to make change, and it may not be in the midterm elections. It may be, but it may not be. It may be, you know, 4 years down the road. It may be 6 years down the road. But if you can see local change happening and put women in the pipeline to be more successful in the political sphere, then down the road, there will be a better representation of women's rights politically.
Yeah, it definitely feels like there was a momentum. Like the Women's March really was, it was the I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. So honestly, it's like, it is this kind of crucifixion martyrdom of Hillary Clinton, right? Where she, for the last 20, 30 years has just kind of been the straw man for everything that we want to throw at women and all of the evils. And she is a witch, right? She is just the old school, absolute witch. She just soaks up everything that we have to throw at women and keeps marching, right? I think that is her standard and how she moved through that, through the entire election and then in the post-election world, I think is, you know, the blue wave, and it had a peak, but it is not quitting, right? I think the big fear that so many feminists and progressive had is that people would just get bored. And of course they did. And of course we saw fewer people coming out later, but it is not done. And women are not sitting down. There is absolutely a momentum that is moving forward. And it is sort of this divided time. And I think women are no longer saying, I'm afraid to lose, because they have seen Hillary Clinton had the biggest, most public, most terrible loss on the face of the planet, right? You're in Austria. The entire world saw her take it in the kidneys, right? And just stand up the next day and say, nope, we're moving forward now. So I think that was a beacon for a lot of people. And women have been taught to be afraid to lose, and we're taught to be afraid of making men angry, right? Because of the terrible consequences that can follow. And I think enough women now say, I'm more afraid of what will happen to me if I don't keep fighting.
Yeah. I also think that the next generation, the kids that are turning 18, we need to increase voter participation among 18-year-olds, 18 to 25-year-olds, because they're the ones who get it. Mm. They're the ones who are all about intersectional feminism. Mm.
They're the ones protesting gun laws at the moment. More power to them.
Right. I mean, they're the ones who understand that this is an issue. This is a public health crisis, that this is about life. And if you can care about life, then do something about the crap about the Second Amendment.
Yeah. So we had the women's marches basically all over the world. We have Me Too right now, Time's Up. So it's just so interesting that against the background of this, and I think a lot of those things happened because Donald Trump is the president of the United States. I don't want to give him credit for it, but what I find particularly interesting is that he is an alleged and self-proclaimed sexual predator, right? So at least 19 women came forward accusing him of all kinds of sexual violence. And he said himself that he grabs women by the pussy, right? So, and against that background, we have the Me Too movement. So I think it's really, it's just a very, very interesting time. And I also feel like now this is kind of a new wave of feminism, which is not just happening online anymore, but people are going on the streets again and actually doing things, you know? So it kind of mobilized a lot of people and women in particular, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a long time it's been a lot of like digital activism, posting a picture on Facebook and like feeling like you were doing your part. Mm-hmm. But I think people are realizing that that's not enough anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like Facebook activism isn't actually activism and that you have to be willing to do more.
And actually, after Trump was elected president, I was like, what can I do? And I came up with the idea of making a feminist podcast, and then I posted on Facebook and Liz said yes, and Beth and Heather back then. So this is actually how She Who Persisted came into being. So, yeah.
And it is important to have like these women's spaces, to have these organizing spaces. And that was the thing that came out of the 2016 election is, of course, they were critiqued because it was a place where women felt safe and things happened for women. And that's never good enough. But, you know, kind of these women only, Hillary only spaces, private groups came up on the internet. You know, a couple of them, one in particular that I'm a part of is it's like the feminist consciousness raising sessions of the 70s that were so important. You cannot dismiss how important it was to have these spaces where women came together to talk in a safe place about their oppression and be strong and powerful. And those spaces, mm-hmm. the internet has made those spaces possible, right? And these podcasts and these ways of micro-organizing, right? It's kind of like, mm-hmm. How do you feed and water yourself so that you can be strong mm-hmm. to go out mm-hmm. and do these things? You can't stop in mm-hmm. these spaces, but we can't dismiss the importance of these spaces.
Yeah.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Amy, thank you. For joining us.
Yeah,
tonight.
I love to talk about feminism. It's like how guys like to talk about like March Madness and the Final Four, right? And they just sit around for hours just bullshitting about basketball.
Oh God.
Right? And I'm like, no, let's talk about feminism. Let's put together.
I'll bullshit about feminism.
What's your
all day.
Final Four like fantasy football dream team? I get Angela Davis and Shirley Chisholm and Gloria Steinem and Eleanor Roosevelt. Okay, who do you get?
Ooh, that's good. That's nice.
Oh, wow.
I mean, bell hooks. Oh, crap. I'm going to go old school and do a, like, Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know what? I'm going Ellen Browning Scripps.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Because. Yeah. Because. And, I don't know. I have to think about the others. There's so many.
Yeah. I mean, like fantasy feminism. Let's do it. Let's have a fantasy feminist league.
So mine are Johanna Donal, who's an Austrian that we talked about last time. She's really like an idol of mine. Bell Hooks to Gloria Steinem. And then Beyonce.
Oh, Beyonce. Yes.
Because she's so inspiring to me. I love her.
All right. So, I guess that's it.
Thanks, ladies. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Amy. To your listeners, if you want to support the show, you can do that on Patreon. So that's patreon.com/shewhopersisted. One thing that will also really help us if you rate and review us on iTunes, because that's how other people find us. If you want to tell us something, then you can write us an email, shewhopersistedpodcast@gmail.com. We also have a Facebook group for discussion. We have a Facebook page. We have a Twitter account, She Persisted Pod. Our homepage is shewhopersisted.com. And
we'll have show notes about this episode that include links if you want more information about any of the things we talked about.
Yeah. And I'll also, I promise that I'll use Instagram a lot more and put up pictures that actually make sense and actually use Instagram for what it's there for, which is posting pictures. So look out for that too. Yeah. Thank you for listening and stay nasty.
Stay nasty.
Bye.